Ghoulish greetings, everyone. The tunes are courtesy of my dear friend, Bobby Mackey. And I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow.
Now today it's a different place, all the same with a new face. With strange mysteries hanging in the air. People in their sane minds swear they see you today. Are you looking for the love they took away? Everyone knows that you couldn't bear the pain. So you took your life.
Thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift, whenever you listen and wherever you are listening from tropical paradise to the ski resort town, from tiny remote village to the biggest of cities and everything in between, it is greatly appreciated. This week's special city shoutouts go to Nantes, France, Needham, Massachusetts, Temple Hills, Maryland, Guwahati, India, Santo Andre, Brazil, and Maspalomas, Spain. Definitely need your passport for this special city shoutouts, right? So last week, you heard all about the Tsavo man eating maneless male lions that terrorized the Tsavo region. Between the two brothers, close to 40 perished, but the number is believed to be much higher. Now we move on to Mafue, located in Zambia, where we encounter yet another maneless South African lion, this one responsible for at least 6 deaths. He was measured at 10 feet long, 3.9 feet tall, and he weighed 500 pounds. Wowza, that's a big cat, making this ever-so-deadly predator the largest man-eating lion that has ever been documented. Now, sadly, there was a case of mistaken identity, and innocent blood was shed as a lioness from a local pride was hunted and killed because it was believed that she was the culprit. But it couldn't have been further from the truth, as due to him being maneless, they did believe it was a female, and the local pride just happened to be plumb full of lionesses. The Mafue lion was viciously taking down his prey, then consuming the remains, leaving almost nothing behind. Now, the first known kill that takes place is August of 1991, when two young boys are innocently walking down the road at night. Not much is going on, not many people are out and about at this point, and little do these two boys know that a deadly predator is watching their every single move, stalking them, and he goes in for the kill. One boy, he manages to escape, thank God. But the other boy, his friend, is brutally attacked. And based on what was found, or their lack of, just some clothing scattered about and a little bit of skull fragments, it's obvious that this poor lad was consumed by his attacker. Talk about the truly unfortunate case of being at the wrong place at the wrong time. Not too terribly much time goes by when another person would fall victim to the Mafue lion. This time it wouldn't be a small child, but a woman who was in her home. While in Tsavo, we saw the victims were being attacked and grabbed from the tents, many with open doors for easy access, but this was a home, a place where you would think someone would be safe from the wildlife, but no such luck for this individual. Like the boy before her, death did not come peacefully nor calmly. What's terrifying about this specific case is, again, she was in her home, where the boy was outside walking, a place that would not be shocking to have an encounter with wildlife that was local to the area. This woman was in her very home. Now, cases like this exist in other areas too. I've read about people being killed in their homes or other buildings or structures by break-in intruders, such as bears, mountain lions, and other large, beautiful, but ever so deadly predators. Now, I watched several videos on YouTube about this lion, and one in particular stood out. And it's by Craig Hodge, and it's titled Zambia Man-Eating Mafue Lion. He talks about a specific attack, the second victim that we're going to talk about now, and actually a friend of his who was there after the attack. Seeing the aftermath, he was only 15 years old at the time that this took place, and I now will quote him from this specific YouTube video. Quote, "We went to the house. I remember very well. We peeked into the house, and what we saw, where she was sleeping, it was nicely laid, which indicated that the woman may have been outside the house at the time, when the lion was stalking her, and when she was getting into the house, because what happened, half the door was destroyed. The door was a packed maize stalk. It wasn't a heavy door. It was a traditional door in the village then. So Mose thought she was outside the house, and when she saw the lion very close up, that's when she thought of retreating by getting in the house, which was too late for her, unquote. In this same video, again, you can find on YouTube by Craig Hodge, they go in detail about the sixth victim, who is an elderly lady who at the time of the attack, she had been at home. It was a mud and wattle hut. Now at this point in the day, basically everybody that lived around her had called it a day and retired for the evening, but not this woman. She was sitting in her doorway. She was probably enjoying the peace and quiet. Think she had a beer. She was taking in the fresh air. I mean, this sounds wonderful. I would probably be doing the exact same thing. It's nice and quiet. The fresh air, my favorite beverage in hand, just enjoying life. I would totally be right there with her. And sadly, she would be doing this for the very last time. And sadly, she did not notice the predator that was silently watching her every single move. The next day, blood would be discovered and huge paw prints. I mean, this guy was a beast, larger than the Tsavo man-eating brother lions. Another attack turns deadly when a boy is mauled. And like the first case, he was out walking on the road. He was close to a ranger station, and a game ranger was close by. And when he sees what's happening, and most likely is hearing what's taking place, he shoots a warning shot into the air, which stops the attack, and the predator manages to run off. Now, while this action saved the boy from certainly being consumed by the feline, it sadly did not save his life. And the boy, he would eventually die due to his ever so brutal injuries. So most of these attacks have taken place in August. In September of 1991, the Mifue lion would strike three more times. The final one, like the second case, was a woman being tracked down from her home. He returned to the scene of the crime the following day, and remember, this is the woman who was sitting in her doorway, just enjoying the day, having a beer. And he wandered through the victim's home the day after the attack. He finds a bag of her clothing, and he would take it with him, just like this bag of clothing, and it would be found a mile's distance from her home. And for days after this last death, people would find an article of her clothing here and another article over there. And it was almost like he was taunting the villagers. Who would be next? Is what must have been running through their minds. And the day that the Mifue lion himself would meet his maker, he unsuccessfully tries to capture a teenage boy. But the child was quick, on his feet, and successfully escapes the lion's wrath. Again, like the first case of the two boys where one was actually able to escape. It must have been quite a traumatizing encounter for both survivors. I mean, something seriously had to be done, right? This cannot continue any longer. People, they were dying. Nobody was safe. And like the case almost 100 years earlier, people were being eaten. It was utterly terrifying. People were crippled with fear. I read an interesting article from scientificamerican.com when it comes to the hunting of this ever so deadly creature. And I want to read a little part of that right now. Quote, "The Mifue man-eater's reign was put to an end by Californian hunter Wayne Hosek. Hosek wasn't the first to try and kill the Mifue lion. A professional hunter and a Japanese hunter and naturalist had both tried earlier. Hosek was already in the area with permission to hunt individuals from a list of large mammal species, lion among them." There's the whole debate here about controlled hunting and its contribution to the economy and conservation versus its abuse at the hands of the unscrupulous the selective impact it has on animal populations, and ethics of trophy hunting. I am somewhat mystified by the idea that anyone could look at a lion, elephant, or a hippo and feel compelled to shoot it to death. But my personal perspective on this matter is that giving live wildlife an actual dollar value, it can only be a good thing, at least if you want live wildlife to still be present in future decades. Anyways, Hozak and professional hunter Charles Bukes sat for about 3 weeks in a hide, hoping that a nearby bait of hippo meat would attract the cat and allow them to kill it. Early attempts were unsuccessful. The lion even circled the meat one night, but was so stealthy that it avoided all detection. Eventually, Hozak succeeded in killing it. On the lion's death, people swarmed out of the village to spit at the animal and beat it with sticks. Unquote. It was indeed a true celebration for the people. Not only did they spit on the corpse and beat its remains, they also sang, cheered, and they danced throughout the area. You would have thought it was a wedding the way they were so happy and acting on. Now in the Tsavo Duo lion case, we saw injuries to the jaws in both of the cats. Why did the Mafue lion begin to claim human lives versus the animals that are normally on his menu, that the village had plenty of, by the way? Upon the lion's death, his body was fully examined. Just why exactly did this lion go on this killing spree? The answer was literally in the mouth of the killer lion. Sometime in his life, somehow and some way, Mafue had suffered a jaw fracture that was so severe, mind you, that it prevented him from eating what lions naturally would eat, like gazelles, zebras, deer, and other large animals. Animals that may fight back, perhaps kick. So it makes sense why he started preying on humans, and it especially makes sense that he was going for children, who are more likely easy to bring down than an adult. Now, each of these three man-eating, maneless lions had injuries with their teeth and jaws. I don't know if sympathetic is the right word, as they ended many human lives, but for instance, when I had a bleeding ulcers in my throat, like several years ago, well over a decade, it hurt to eat anything. I had to take it easy and eat only soup, and only certain soups at that. I was able to make my food or go to the store and get it and prepare it at home. These animals, like all wild and feral animals, of course, don't have that luxury. They never know when their next meal is going to be. Okay, my teeth are screwed up, so I can't eat that water buffalo or antelope, so I'll have to go to the store and get some pork chops that are already prepped. No, they had to do what they had to do to survive. And unfortunately, they went for game that wasn't as challenging and it was much easier to take down. Human life. Smithsonian shows an image of the skull of one of these lions, unsure if it was one of the Tsavo lions or a Mafue lion, and a close-up of a tooth, and oh, my lord, my jaw just hurt looking at it. The left bottom large tooth is broken and corroded. No way could he have used that to hunt his regular game. And it must have hurt like hell. Today, you can visit all three of these man-eating lions that I talked about these last couple of weeks. Just head on over to Chicago and hit up the Field Museum of Natural History, as the Tsavo brothers and the Mafue lion now call this museum their forever home. In 1998, Wayne Hozak would donate the Mafue lion to the Field Museum. While Wayne lives in California, he is a Chicago native. And when he decided to donate the lion, there was absolutely no question in this gentleman's mind where this lion would be going. It's really neat, actually. As a boy, Wayne and his father would spend many hours going to this museum where they spent a lot of time learning about animal conservation and wildlife in Africa and just oh so much more. So it's super appropriate that the Mafue lion, who wreaked havoc and was responsible for at least 6 deaths that we know of, is now here at the museum in Chicago. Now, speaking of man-eaters, there is a place that I go to when I can, located in the San Luis Valley in Colorado, not too far from the sand dunes, and it's called Colorado Gators Reptile Park. It's family-owned, and it is a great place to go check out. I mean, every time I go there, I have been able to interact with the beautiful tortoises roaming about. This includes petting them and feeding them. I've gotten to hold several different types of snakes, non-venomous, of course, and for a certain amount of dollars, you can actually get trained to wrestle a gator. Never done it, but hey, maybe someday. They have a wonderful variety of creatures to check out, including, of course, alligators. They even feature a celebrity gator who calls this place his forever home, Morris. You may know Morris by watching Happy Gilmore. Yes, he is the gator in that movie. Him and Adam Sandler go way back. Also there on exhibit is a large stuffed saltwater croc. This was no purchase or donation, but one of the beloved owners, I believe, actually hunted and took down this man-eater. Next to the killer croc is his story. And it was really interesting, so interesting that I took a picture of it, knowing someday that I would be talking about it on a future episode. And why not right now? We're talking about man-eaters. I find it very appropriate to do so. And so we're going to end this episode with me reading from that plaque right now. And this is the story of the killer croc. Quote, "We headed toward a little area in a clearing where people of the fish, as I called them, had set up camp. People were milling about, laying fish out to dry and then smoked. The people of the fish had traveled by foot from Zambia to sell the fish during dry season. Although the African women in the camp were dressed in bright attire, others were less ornate and looked like they had found old clothing that may have been distributed by visiting Americans. People were friendly, but quiet. Suspicious, I thought, about what our intentions were. Neither Martin nor I engaged in conversation because they spoke a dialect with which we were not familiar. After 20 minutes or so, we jumped up into the truck and headed off to another area occupied by the people of the corn. As we looked at small plots of gardens, it was obvious that elephants had damaged plant growth by pulling up stalks and stomping on what was left behind, compromising any success at growing corn. While we kicked the dirt and walked around their living area, the people of the corn watched us carefully. Rob was pulled aside by a man who was the spokesperson for them. Rob relayed back to us. Their leader had asked if Marty would be willing to help them with a problem they were experiencing with a large crocodile that took residence down the hill on the water's edge, where children played while women washed clothes and filled buckets from the river. The croc, they said, was eating their children. In fact, they were grabbing 1 to 2 children a month. They had no weapons for protection, and Rob, Marty, and the village leader began to sort out the problem and hatch a plan. The plan was to walk through the cornfield down to the water, get in a dugout canoe and land on an island between the village and the other side of the Zambezi River, where the croc was frequently spotted. Getting into the dugout canoe became an issue for me and Marty. He said, "Pat, you go first." And I said, "Marty, you go first." And we went back and forth while watching water seep into the canoe even before either one of us stepped foot into what was clearly an unstable form of transport. Finally, to settle the argument, I asked Rob who should go first to stabilize the canoe, and he said, "Well, typically, the heaviest person should get in first." And with that, Marty reluctantly planted his foot in the canoe, and I climbed in after him. Both of us feared rocking the canoe and spilling over into the croc-infested waters. Once we were in the boat and found some balance, we began to use the handmade bowl at the base of the vessel to drain some of the water that was collecting quickly. Within minutes, we arrived at the edge of the island and could not wait to climb out. The island was a perfect place to search for the croc. It was thick with flesh-cutting reeds that provided cover for predators. Marty carried his gun. I carried my camera, and along with Rob, Thomas, Albert, and the village chief, we crept through the swamp. Snorting and huffing nearby were hippos that could be heard but not seen. We did not know how many encircled the island or if other crocs or hippos were also on the island, so we proceeded with caution to get to the other side of the island. And there he was, all 14 feet of him, sunning himself in the morning sun on the edge of the shore, halfway in and halfway out of the water. And he was big, all right. Marty asked if that was the croc that had been tormenting the villagers. When he was told it was, Marty settled in and began to set up his shooting stick. Rob also pulled out his gun. I positioned my camera on a tripod. They did not want to take any chances of wounding him and exacerbate the potential for even more danger. Marty took one shot and struck the croc precisely between the eyes. Rob took a second shot to ensure his death. The croc stayed put, blood began to flow. And once again, we had to get into the dugout canoe and make our way across the water to the bank where the croc laid. Cheers erupted. Several teenage boys who have been following us began to celebrate. An older woman appeared out of the bush and began to dance. Incredibly young women with babies tied to their waists began to clap and dance. One young man straddled the croc. More village people joined in the celebration. Many poked the croc with sticks and examined his body closely. Young girls asked me to take their pictures and squealed when they saw images of themselves with their babies on the viewfinder. Marty had slayed the dragon. Relief, gratitude, and excitement filled the air. We sat in the shade for about an hour watching the village people just enjoy the day. I got up to wander around a bit with my camera. While along the shoreline, I spotted a hippo in the water that began to come toward me as I snapped my camera. Quickly, Rob fired his gun into the water toward the hippo, announcing, "That ought to teach him a lesson." The hippo swam away, and Marty suggested I give the camera a rest. Rob had radioed back to camp that we had taken a croc. A boat powered by a Mercury motor showed up. About 8 strong young men and Marty had tied a blue rope around the croc to get some leverage while they pushed him into the floor of the boat for transport back to camp. And it was time to climb back once again into the dugout canoe to make our way back to the mainland, with children swimming next to the canoe doing a dog paddle with a lot of splashing. And it became clear to us the croc was naturally attracted to such movement, and it was no surprise that small children were losing their lives to this predator who was looking for nothing more than something to eat, unquote. And here ends yet another man-eating story. If you go to Colorado Gator Farm today, you will absolutely see this stuffed crocodile, all in its 14-foot glory. And I can't imagine running into one of those bad boys in the water. You know, when I first moved to North Carolina, we would be on the boat, or at times in our little raft that we had given away to a few kids on the river since, and we would see alligators. We had seen this huge gator. He had to be around 12, 13 feet, and he was sunning himself. And he saw us, and he kind of runs into the water, and we actually got stuck on a log, and so we were there for several hours. And my boyfriend had to keep going into the water, and I was watching this bad boy like my life depended on it, or like his life depended on it. And my camera got some spectacular shots and was just watching him as Justin was trying to get us free from this log. And I mean, it was just amazing. He just sat there, watched us. He would move around a little, never got too close, but it was still pretty unnerving. I mean, don't get me wrong, I absolutely adore wildlife. You look at my camera, I have hundreds of pictures. If they're not about haunted locations or abandoned buildings, they're all animal. Bald eagle here, hawk there, a deer, whatever. And gators, of course. I love wildlife, but man, I admire from a distance for sure. My love, thoughts, and prayers definitely go out to all the victims that lost their lives to these ever-so-deadly predators. Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They're all amazing. Haven't heard every single one yet? No need to cry, lose sleep, or fret over. Just hit up any of those podcast platforms, such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Deezer, Blueberry, basically wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts. You'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everyone, and I will see you next week.